Session number 9796, William Spearman, Reel 7.
Dieppe, when that happened, was a frontal assault on a heavily defended town and port. And here we were again, number 4 Commando, from the whole Marine Commando Brigade, we were given the task of doing a frontal assault on Flushing, which was a heavily defended port. The idea of the raid, of course, was in order that we could open up the port of Antwerp, as I've said, for the supplies to come through. And as I say, this was the first such raid since Dieppe. But at Dieppe, we had no intention of staying, but here at Flushing, it was different. We were going to take the place and stay there. Somebody was going to stay there. Now, Flushing is on a sort of an island called Walcheren. So this was an operation really on Walcheren, and the rest of the the rest of the Marine Brigade were going to do landings around the coast. West Capel was one of the places they landed, but anyway, as far as number 4 Commando were concerned, we had a very serious task on our hands, because the whole approaches on the water in that area was most heavily defended, and the Germans had been in that position now for 4 years, and the whole time we expected and found out to be true afterward, they spent the whole of their 4 years of occupation there fortifying the defences around Flushing, because they realised the importance of Antwerp. So we knew this, well, Dieppe was the same, but we knew this in particular was going to be very heavily defended. And from our positions, we were in a place called Breskins, I remember. And when I refer to my album, of course, this is refreshing my memory about places and names and occurrences that happened. And from Breskins, you could see across, and you could see the heavy fortifications even from that distance. Anyhow, the garrison in Flushing, in the town of Flushing and around the town of Flushing, defending Flushing, were 3,000 Germans. And they had some very heavy artillery, and they were all ensconced in heavily fortified barracks, and they had underground fortifications and things. They spent a long time digging in there. So here we were. I think there were 20 landing craft were to take us over, and there were, I think, 550 of us again going over. And this meant that we were taking on six times our own numbers, and against odds which seemed impossible, because the Germans had been there for 4 years and it was terribly heavily defended. I mean, our record, of course, was suited for the job, but it has to be remembered we had the new intakes. There are only a few of the original commandos, you know, a few, I suppose about a third of them. Of course, some of the people who got wounded had returned to us. It wasn't quite as bad as that, but we had a lot of new people who obviously hadn't been indoctrinated into battle, into assault landings like this, because no doubt about it, if you have the element of surprise and do a raid, everything is on your side, and if you react quickly and get moving, you can generally come up on the trump side. Anyhow, just to carry on with the story, the night before we were going to do the raid, because we would be embarking on these AOCs, the landing craft, at 3 o'clock in the morning in the dark, it was decided by the powers to be that we would have a rehearsal of this embarkation the day before. But we were within sighted distance of the defences of Flushing over there. We could be seen. It was very close. So they actually put up a smoke screen to hide the activity of us getting into the boats and this sort of thing. And halfway through the activity, the bloody wind changed and moved the smoke screen. So if they were looking, they obviously saw it. We knew they had seen it, because the next thing, bloody shelling. They started dropping artillery shells all around the port where we were. So anyway, we got out of the boats and withdrew for the night, because we were up again at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then this was another worry in our cap, because they, in a way now, must have seen that. They didn't know we were coming the next morning, but it must have again put them on the alert, you know. They were on the alert anyway, because Arnhem and all the activity, and they knew that Antwerp was an important thing, and I'm sure they'd been warned to be on their guards. Anyway, it appeared we were going to be supported either by air bombardment or by a few regiments of artillery, both light and heavy artillery, which was worth knowing. In other words, the area, the town, like previously I've told you about the gun batteries we raided, they were shelled and machine gunned by aircraft before, and this was going to be a very, very heavy bombardment on the town of Flushing and its defences to allow us to get in. And of course it was the only solution really, so everything really hinged on us in our boats being at the right minute to land before the shells stop, before the bombardment stopped, because immediately that stopped, the Germans in their fortified position would have their heads up and have their guns out, and so we just had that few seconds, that few minutes, I suppose you might say, to make this landing. Immediately the shelling stopped. Of course, it was arranged for the shelling to move further away as we were landing. Now, the difficulty about this particular landing was that nobody knew exactly where we could land, because when it was examined, I mean, we knew the position from aerial photographs, and we had little models made in the usual way, like we always did when we went on a raid. But everywhere looked so difficult to land on. I mean, there were stakes sticking out from everywhere, and we knew from information that there were mines and explosives attached to all these stakes, so if you touch one, the whole bloody boat would go up. So we knew there was a big windmill there, and we knew that this is the sort of place we wanted to land in, because there was a road beside the windmill that actually led right out of the area and past the barracks and into the town. Of course, we had some Dutch commando. We had a Dutch commando with us, and we had a French commando with us, and we all had a pre-arranged plan to go to a certain part of Flushing, and we all had our pre-given task to do. But we had to get out of this heavily defended port area and into the town before we could start doing it. So somebody had to take this risk, and we set out on the boat anyhow. And of course, these AOCs, these landing craft, are very low in the water, and of a night time, it's impossible for them to be seen from the shore. But as the boat moves, being a flat bow front on the boat, it kicks up a lot of water as it moves forward, and this sends all this white spray around. So this can be seen, this white spray. So when any shooting starts at these boats, we know from experience that this white water draws attention when you're near enough to the boats coming in. They don't actually see the boat because the silhouette is not seen in the dark, you know. In the daytime, of course, it would be seen against the bright sky behind, but at the night time, they're quite invisible. You're quite safe in them until you start moving fast and the water, white water comes up. And then when they open up, it's an optical thing. They see this white water and open up on it, but the shell, the bullets and, you know, the ammunition goes right over your head. Something about firing at water like that, they always aim too high. So you know this, you're not too worried about when somebody shoots at you like that while it's still dark, because you're fairly safe. Anyway, that was our problem. We had to go there and land at a precise moment. If we didn't, we'd all be in trouble. But not knowing exactly where we were to land made it doubly difficult. Anyway, there was one boat, I think it was my troop. Anyway, I was in the boat which was dedicated to land first, find a place and land first. And then our job then was to get ashore. There were minefields there. And lay this white tape down. It was a pure chance, really, whether the person taking the tape survived or not, but we had to have a white tape to get right out of the area for all the other people coming in so they could follow in the dark on this white tape. So I can't remember too much about this, but this shelling was going on, and our boat was on its own because the others were coming up behind, and we went in slowly to not to create any attention to ourselves. And we had a fair idea. There was a big windmill there, and all we knew that we wanted to land near this windmill. C- because we knew this windmill on our models. We knew where we would be if we get near this windmill, but we weren't sure whether we'd get there. Anyway, we negotiated all these stakes and all these problems, and we eventually came to what is known over there as the mole. It's a sort of a promontory that runs out into the water, and it's got, if I remember it rightly, had dugouts and fortifications and concrete things there where the Germans were sitting inside. And the mole where we landed, it had sort of cobbles out of the water. It wasn't an easy place to land on. Anyway, this is where we eventually landed. It's called the mole. So then when the shelling eventually started moving backwards, and just before it stopped, we rushed ashore. And there wasn't a shot fired. We got ashore with this white tape, and our immediate first job was to make a beachhead, as it were, which we did quite easily, even though we were climbing over the fortifications, because we felt there wouldn't be mines in certain areas, and there were. We got away. There wasn't a mine when we did our job. There wasn't a mine went off, so we were extremely lucky. And we got into this and got the beachhead going, and I don't know, but I suppose then a signal was given, or it was done automatically, the other boat started coming in. Now, by this time, the bombardment was beginning to finish, and the incoming craft behind us were spotted by certain, by, I don't know by whom, they were spotted, and this machine gun opened up on them. All sorts of firing opened up on them. A lot of them got in and got away with it. A couple of them got blown up by hitting these stakes and went up. And our job wasn't to assault or to take these strong points on this mole. Our job was to make the beachhead and then get out of the place and go ahead. We had a job. I can't remember what specific job we had, but I know that we did no fighting in the bunkers, or it wasn't our job to winkle out these Germans on this mole. Our job was to get ahead, which we did, and the people following up afterwards, they were the ones who shot up these Germans in these things. So in that way, we were very successful. My particular boat got out, got on the land without being fired at. The others got fired at behind. And so,
who was in charge of your boat?
A fella called Rucastle. And can't remember what rank he was. He was an officer. And if I remember rightly, he was a fairly new officer. And he was a bloody good bloke, actually. A youngish fella. Well, I can't remember too much about him. But having read the books on... Again, you can't get a lot of information from books, because of all the books of number 4 commander which were written, all the ones I know about were written by officers. Other ranks like myself didn't have the education or didn't... We were all very young. Well, the officers, of course, were young also, but all the books anyway were written. I'm sure they were all written by the officers, like Lord Lovett and the intelligence officer, Mr. MacDoodle, and another Scottish chap called, I forget his name for the moment. But the point I was getting at here, that they were always written by officers, one, and of course not one of these officers did all the raid, like Lord Lovett. He came in and he got badly wounded on the second front, so we never saw him again. So Flushing was without him, so he couldn't tell you about Flushing in his book on the life of Four Commando. MacDoodle, he wasn't on the earlier raids. Lovett wasn't on the earlier raid, I don't think. So the point I'm getting, a lot of these stories really are told from a new point of view. Somebody writes a book, they've had some of the raid, but they haven't had all the raids. So there hasn't been a lot really written about Flushing. There have been a couple, maybe more than I know about. So as far as refreshing my memory is concerned, it's very difficult to do. I'm not in touch with I'm in the Commando Association, but I don't, I've had a very active license then, so I've lost touch. So it's very hard to refresh your memory, and since I came in contact with you, of course I've been trying to dig things out of the past, but I still find it very difficult. Anyway, we got off the mole, the people behind got the worst of it, we were lucky again. You have the element of surprise, we always know this, if you go on a raid, you've got all the advantage, you've got the element of surprise, which is a great thing. Anyway, Flushing is sort of a square sort of town as far as I remember it, and we had the front, one sort of quarter section of it. Now, the battle, just to say it briefly, I think we took Flushing in 3 days. which was a good achievement. I think there were 500, over 500 of them. We took it in 3 days. But it was a different type of warfare that we'd ever experienced before. The raid, the landing, was as normal, but then when you got into the town, it was all street fighting. And this was horrific in a way. It's, you know, you mass hole from one building to another building, and there's shelling going on. You don't know what the hell's going on, really. Nobody can at any one time tell you what the hell's happening. Eventually, messages come through on the radio, on the telephone, you know, on the radio thing that you carry around. And gradually, somebody at the top is in overall control, but you never know it. All you know is that you've got to take this block of houses, you know. And all hell lets loose because you go down the street and go into the house and you're under fire. You can't do this. So you have to start going, breaking down walls. Although I must say that after that bombardment, the whole of the town that I saw was a complete wreck. It was shelled, and you know, every house had a hole in it into which you could go. I mean, I don't know how the Dutch people survived that raid, quite honestly. I don't know how many were killed or anything like that. Our own casualties turned out not to be too bad. When you look at the odds that were against us in the first place, you'd have thought very few would survive. But we did, anyhow. But it was very nasty, this crawling from one house to another. I can't recall any specific instances. I mean, hundreds of them flashed through my mind of dashing from one house to another. And I remember being up on the second floor of this. We were held up by a strong point on a crossroad a few mile away from us. About a mile away, if I remember rightly. I can picture it now, in a way. And I was up on the second floor, and I was a sniper. I was quite good at, quite accurate with my shooting, and I know I got myself a position out of this window. You can't poke a rifle out of the window because everybody sees you, but you can sneak it gradually horizontally outside the window, you know, and take up quite a comfortable position. But anyway, I was doing this. I killed a couple of, well, I shot a couple of people and they fell down. And this was from this window. I mean, previously we'd been throwing grenades and giving bursts of fire to people as we came into rooms. It was horrific, really. You get used to it after a couple of days, although you've never done it before. But from this window, really, it was more in my line. You got up a position like that and you started picking people off from a distance. But I was just doing this anyway when somebody saw me and they fired back. It wasn't a 303, it was some heavier calibre gun. It was probably from, I don't know what it was, I can't remember now. But anyway, this spatter of bullets hit this side just beside me, and I got blown inside of the room, and I felt a pain in my leg, and I thought, Christ, I've had it again. This is an immediate reaction when anything happens like that. But all it was a splinter from the window went into my leg, and I just got up and carried on. Somebody else was working away. Some other body in our command eventually broke down this crossroad strong point, and we moved on from there. And this leg, I had that bayonet on the Boulogne raid, and now I had this slight wound, which I didn't even see the doctor about, and something had gone inside the leg, but it didn't worry me. But it's still there even to this day. Sometimes I'm in a certain position and my leg goes numb, and I say to my wife, it's definitely that little thing. It's never done any damage, so I never worry about it. But that was just one incident. There were lots of incidents that happened like that. And then anyhow, this carried on, and it took, I think it was 3 days, it may have been four, I think it was 3 days when Flushing was finished and we had the town. And then the Marines had been in some sort of trouble. They were in a lot of trouble, actually, in a place called West Capelle. They came in on these waterborne vehicles, ducks they call them. I think they came out first then. We didn't see it, but from our point of view, we were the one Army commando in a Marine commando brigade, and they gave us what appeared to be the toughest job. A heavily defended port, and do a frontal assault on it, just one commando. You know, so we were always taken back by that, but in the event, we did our job and had few casualties, we were lucky. But at West Capelle, it was the most heavily defended beach, and they run into all sorts of trouble, had terrific casualties. I believe they really proved their worth there, because we weren't there and we didn't see it. But I'm sure if you read the books about it, it will tell you. But they were in some sort of trouble, And we got an urgent message that we had to, even before almost Flushing was taken, we'd just taken it, and we must have had a signal to say it was all over, as far as that was concerned. And we thought, well, thank God for that, because it wasn't a very nice experience, the street fighting. I never liked it, nor did anybody else. Although we had a lot of fun there. We beat up these Germans, and we found lots of bottles of wine stores in the barracks, and we found big German swastika flags and pictures of a thing. We got a lot of them in the album, you know. I remember we did, in between the bad parts, get a kick out of it of some sort. But then before we had time to enjoy the end of the battle, we were told to do a night march along to a place called Domburg or something, further around the coast.
Just before we leave Flushing,
yes.
Could you tell me how the Germans fought in Flushing? Did they fight with determination?
In the town of Flushing, the people where we landed, and in the streets, in the fortified barracks, we thought they were very good. They didn't easily give in. Snipers were very hard to dig them out. The crossroads, at the strong points they had, they didn't give in easily. But I will go on to say now that it was different outside of Flushing. Before we had time to sit down and enjoy the winning of the battle, we were told we had to do a night march around the coast, out of Flushing, to this place called Dromberg, to help the rest of the brigade with they were being held up or something. I can't remember the exact details of it. Anyway, we did this night march and we got around to these areas and we started getting shot at and we were shooting things back. But all I can say is that the resistance we met at this time, and I'm sure it's because they'd already been softened up by the Marines, the resistance we found here, while a long-distance shooting, it can be good or bad. You don't know. You're being shot at, so you don't know what the Germans are like. But if I say that at the end of the day, I just made a note here. At the end of the day, about 1,000 Germans surrendered to us, and we hardly put any pressure on them. They were firing at us, and we fired back, and we were making moves to surround their things in a normal way to do an assault and take them up. And almost before we had a chance to go away to get away with this, white flags appeared. Other white flags appeared, and they gradually started surrendering. And in the end, I believe somewhere along the line there were some negotiations taking place between the Germans and our people. I don't know. I wasn't conscious of it. But when I hear about it afterward, negotiation went on, and all the rest of the Germans in this particular area all gave themselves up. So we landed the day with all these thousands of bloody Germans along this beach. We didn't know what to do with them. Never happened to us before. If we had prisoners, they were especially picked prisoners. So at the end of the day, I mean, what the Marines did there was fantastic, and it's well documented about Westkapelle and all the resistance they had. So looking back, and at that time we realised that number 4 commander, even though they had the most daunting task like that, we were lucky. And in the end we didn't get many casualties. So this raid on Flushing and the eventual business around Walker and Ireland afterwards, I mean, all the dikes had been broken then. There was a lot of flooded areas around which we had to negotiate. That was quite dangerous, depending on the time of the day and the way the tides were. So that was a little bit unpleasant, but this was number 4 commando's last action, really, in the war. From there were various islands around the place, so we were appointed to look after these two islands, north of Beveland and south Beveland. Beveland, yeah. North Beveland and south Beveland. And if I remember rightly, one of the islands was inhabited by Roman Catholics, and the other island was inhabited by Protestants. Now, we come from Ireland, of course, we have that divide in Ireland the same way, you know, but if I remember right, the one island was Protestant and one was Roman Catholic. But one of them was occupied by Germans, and we had the other one. I can't remember which one we were on. Although there was no big battles presented to us there and everything, we had to from this island, go around in our boats and keep going across to this occupied island, because what we didn't want any assaults or any approaches being made to Flushing by the Germans. You know, we It was possible if the Germans have had the troops, they could have retaken Flushing and they could have made advances. So our job was really to stop any probes being made by the Germans in order to come down again so they could close Antwerp to our forces. So we had a little job here. This was, it was nothing. We enjoyed it. There were various incidents. We had an Oster aircraft there and a pilot whose job was to go up in the air and direct artillery fire onto the other island, if I remember rightly. And this particular night, I was a sergeant, I was in charge of the bloody guard, and we had one fella called Ginsburg. I remember he happened to be Jewish. He was a very nice fella and a good soldier. But being there in Holland like that, the place is rather flat. And the cold winds coming in, I can't remember when that was, end of September, I think. It was on the 1st of November we did this raid, so it's coming into winter time now. And you used to get the cold winds coming across this flat air with no break, you know, with these cold winds. And we found it extremely cold there. And this Oster aircraft, every night, we had to guard it. Because we used to do raids on this other island, and sometimes we'd pass in our boats, the Germans doing raids on our island. It was funny. It wasn't a war. We were quite happy with the situation. We had this task of making sure that there was no activity by the Germans. And apart from these small boats coming backwards and forwards, there wasn't any activity. But we had this Oster aircraft there as a spotter plane for the artillery. And it was important that we didn't lose it, because it was our only means of observation, being all flat enough, and you can't get your binoculars and look or anything like that. So we had this Oster aircraft attached to us mainly for the artillery, but it gave us information as well. And this particular night, I was on guard, we were on guard. There were about four of us, I think. And this bloke, Ginsburg, when he was on duty on the aircraft, instead of doing what he was told to do and stand around the aircraft, because it was tied down, but it was vibrating in the wind all the time, you know, he decided he couldn't stand the cold, and he went into the aircraft and sat down in the seat, which is a nice thought, but we all bloody know that if you're in a cold situation and get frozen and going inside an aircraft, you're going to fall asleep. You can't do your job properly. So what he did when he was in there, these Oster aircraft, the skin of them is very, very fragile, and cut it short, he put his bloody boot through the bottom of this aircraft, and it wasn't discovered till the following morning. And I got busted because of this, because I was in charge, because I had to take the responsibility of it. I knew it was him who'd done this. So, you know, and this really meant that this Oster aircraft was grounded now until it got repaired. That was just something, an incident I remember. The other thing I remember, even though there's no great battles to talk about here, it was nice and quite breathtaking to go on a boat and go onto an island where there were no Allied army, no other Englishmen. It was occupied by the Germans. It was quite a nice feeling. You got a kick out of it, landing on this island, going around, trying to get information, trying to capture Germans. This is what we wanted, to get information. So there was this sort of kick that you got the adrenaline going. But I'd like to say there's one thing here, that during our four commander time, there was one time when a couple of fellas, got in a boat and rowed across the channel and were picked up by the British Navy, and it was all over the popular press about how these young fellas wanted to go do battle with the Germans, and they got in this boat to go across to France to do it, and they were picked up by the Navy, and they said, if you're so keen to do battle, you can go to the commander. So one of them, a fella called King, he came to our commando. And, you know, we were laughing at it. What the hell can you do, rowing a boat across to France to get to battle with the Germans? How naive can you get, you know? He was going to get his eyes open, we felt, when he come to us, you know, because it wasn't like that. Life isn't like that. But I must admit, he was a very brave bloke, this bloke. In fact, he was so brave that during our time at D-Day, after that time, I went out on a number of patrols with him, and I knew he had a very good nerve and this sort of thing. But he became so good, and such a good leader, that he got commissioned on the field. This speaks very highly of somebody like that. And while we were in Holland on the Beveland Island, they wanted volunteers to go over to the island to stay.